Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So, Brandon, we kicked off Dynamite tonight as viewers getting to see, one, the new world champion, express sort of a mission statement with the title, an interview recorded Saturday night after World's End, and then follow up on the Devil reveal with Adam Cole and his henchmen afterwards. And I thought those were the two main top talking points coming out of Saturday night's pay-per-view. So I liked that. From there, it kind of felt like almost like a Rampage Collision hybrid show a little bit on sort of an off week. Enjoyable. AW is almost always enjoyable. And that's not always a lens I look, you know, that I examine the shows through because I look at it going as this building characters and adding fan interest and building feuds properly. And I have some mixed feelings about the rest of the show in a variety of different ways, which we'll get into. But I'm curious for your overview. This was supposed to be, maybe we made more of it than we should have, but it's the first Dynamite after World's End, first Dynamite after MJF's, loses the world title, Samoa Joe takes over, big payoff to the Devil storyline. Tony Khan saying in a media Q&A that he's thinking that they're going to move away from sports entertainment, more towards sports-like approach, maybe as a throwaway line without a lot of plotting and planning, maybe not. So with all that in mind, how did this work in terms of kicking off the new year, especially to complicate my question, in light of what WWE pulled out on Monday with Raw, with Rock showing up and just, you know, blowing up the wrestling world with that line at the end. So I throw to you for your opening thoughts.
Yeah, I thought they turned the page relatively well. And I'm in your camp of having some mixed feelings overall. I think that there were a couple of things tonight that put me that had me feeling very, very good overall about particular directions and places that they can go with certain divisions, and other areas where I thought that it was either sort of business as usual or even a step backward. So I'm certainly mixed overall. I think that it was an interesting format and presentation, given that they sort of got the two biggest things that they had on the docket out of the way right out of the gate, and then moved through, as you said, kind of like almost an amalgamation of one of their secondary shows, but did so amongst some really, really good wrestling. I think they raised the bar a bit even from what they typically would present on a Wednesday. So it was an interesting show. I do wonder, you know, how much of this format is going to stick going forward. I still find it funny that with all the colors in the color wheel that they choose so heavily to even in a semi redesign go with WWE's two primary colors, but that's neither here nor there.
So let's tackle, because there's a lot to get to here, including, well, yeah, I mean, the first challenger being determined for the Continental Crown title, and it's four randos and a mid-card preliminary guy, completely defining down the new title right out of the gate. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things to talk about here, in addition to the idea that, yeah, really good wrestling, but was the crowd reacting? What was it building to? Was the main event just sort of an excuse for a pull-apart brawl with someone else at the end? That's where some of these mixed feelings come in. We'll get into all that as the show progresses here. But we'll start with Samoa Joe. I think he should have been in the building and cutting a mission statement promo center ring. Now, that said, I really do like the adrenaline rush, sweaty backstage promos. I grew up with seeing those in the AWA when they would run at the St. Paul Civic Center, and some of my favorite promos were right after the match, they'd get backstage, they'd record them, and then they'd show them on the next TV show. And I think it stands out in that way. I'm not entirely sure that I know what we're supposed to take away from what Samoa Joe said. You know, he just said that MJF is a scumbag, but I'm a heartless son of a bitch, and there's not enough room for both of us. I'm Samoa Joe, and I'm the AEW World Champ. I'll take everything from anyone who tries to take this from me. So it was a good generic Samoa Joe promo, but I don't know that I came across feeling like a new era is beginning. And I could do without Excalibur with the tired cliche of it's Samoa Joe's world and we're just living in it. It's like 4 years stale. So what are your thoughts? Like I said, mixed feelings because it wasn't a bad promo, but I felt like this turning of the page, as you said, to Samoa Joe, who did not get a good build going into this match. He was just sort of the guy who was facing MJF in the midst of a storyline regarding the devil, and an injury to MJF might have led to Joe getting a title when they weren't even planning to give him. So maybe they don't even have a real idea of where they're going with him, and maybe that was why it came across, at least the way I saw it, the way that it did. Your thoughts on Joe's promo?
Yeah, I thought it was compelling, but I'm unsure, and maybe this will be clarified for me with, you know, a little bit of time and talking it through, but I'm unsure whether I was so intrigued by it simply because I'm so intrigued by the prospect of Samoa Joe as the face of the company for the next, you know, however long he holds the title, or if because I was actually moved by the promo itself. And I tend to lean toward it being the former. I think that, you know, Joe is a guy who he's the ultimate professional. I mean, you put him in this position and he's almost guaranteed to excel just because that's who he is. And I'm intrigued to see what they do with him and what they do with the championship picture going forward. But I mean, you're right. Fresh off the title win, there wasn't really much for him to say, given that they're trying to move on from MJF, at least temporarily. And so it was just sort of generic, which was fine for a post-match promo, but unfortunately it just kind of leaves a lot to be desired because it's not something that aired initially on Saturday, and there was obviously nothing in between then and Dynamite. So to leave it at that, to have only heard that from Joe, was a little disappointing. But I do like that we had, you know, throughout the show, multiple challengers sort of throwing their hat in the ring and saying that they're coming for that title. If anything, I thought that Joe's stronger promo work overall was done during the scrum after World's End, you know, where he kind of said it, or I'm paraphrasing, but said that, you know, everybody likes to pick fights in AEW right now, but nobody wants to pick a fight with him. And I thought that was a really effective line that spoke to, you know, in a meta sense, what tends to be happening with AEW on a fairly consistent basis, but also just works really well for Joe the character.
Those planned media Q&As afterwards could change how the media members who assemble and the fan club, AEW fan club representatives assemble, because they're not all like really – well, I mean, media is a general term, but not everything there – not everything going on in those media Q&As is journalism. But the footage of that, if the wrestlers are in character or a hybrid of in character or not, is an opportunity to give kind of a cool sports-like vibe to the the fallout from the pay-per-views, and you know, because I like that setting; it stands out. So I'm with you on that. I think there's footage there that can be used. It just, if suddenly it does, I think, you know, the actual reporters who are there, if they start to feel like they're props for a TV storyline or angle, it can kind of undercut the spirit. Hopefully, the spirit of those. So the journalist in me is sort of leery of turning that into TV footage for wrestlers and character, because then it's like, I don't even think. Reporters should show up to that and participate, because now you're becoming part of the show. And I don't know that AEW thinks about that, but I think reporters should. And maybe AEW should, out of respect to the job reporters are trying to do. But that aside, yeah, I wanted more. Like I wanted a sense of Joe coming across as an alpha. And Joe is so good when Joe is just being Joe and not a frothing, screaming, in-character Samoa Joe pro wrestler act. There's something very alpha. He's just a leader. He's a badass. This was a culmination of you know, 2 decades of a journey for him to win the most prestigious title he's had. And it did, it was a good promo, but it felt a little like a generic Samoa Joe promo. And I wanted something more grandiose. I wanted this to feel like a historically significant moment. And instead he's saying MJF embarrassed him and cheated and used everything at his disposal to keep the belt from him. And he took everything from him in front of his friends and family. That's sort of a generic promo. I want, if MJF's going to be gone for a while, who's Joe? What does this mean to Joe? Don't make it about MJF. Make it more about where this fits into the journey Samoa Joe has been on. And I don't know. Like, I just, there's part of me that just wanted this promo to be produced differently and feel bigger than it did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's definitely a lot to that. And the biggest thing is, as you mentioned, if MJF is going to be out of the picture for a while, it does make sense to pivot pretty quickly and have Joe, you know, declare a mission statement. As much as I've enjoyed this character, and as much as I thought that they handled it exceptionally well up to the point of revealing him as being in cahoots with the devil, just before World's End, Joe hadn't been presented in all that impressive fashion prior to. I mean, he was, yes, a dominant champion in Ring of Honor, but that is sort of a derivative, not only title, but promotion in general at this point. I don't think holding a Ring of Honor title really sets you up in any particular way to challenge for an AEW title, especially the AEW World Championship. So I do think that it is important that as he appears weekly on TV going forward, I would hope that that's the plan, that there is more attention paid to building that aura around him. And I think that they definitely did miss an opportunity tonight by not having him in the building.
Yeah. Yep. All right. We can talk more about that as show progresses, but let's pause. Let's formally introduce ourselves, and then we'll talk about the Devil storyline reveal and more. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024. I'm Wade Keller, host of the show, and we are here talking AEW Dynamite, the first Dynamite, the first AEW production of the new year 2024. Thanks for joining us. The other voice you hear on the show is Brandon LeClaire. He is a contributor to PWTorch.com. His latest contributions are covering pay-per-views at our website, PWTorch.com. In-depth match reports along with his analysis. Brandon, now co-hosting with Greg Parks regularly after those pay-per-views on Wrestling Night in America, our live call-in show similar to this, but on the PW Torch Daily Cast feed after pay-per-views. Brandon, welcome to the co-host chair here after Dynamite.
Yeah, glad to be here. I feel like I've done plenty of Torch shows since, you know, in the month of December, but I was looking back and I don't think I've joined you on one of these since November.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while. So I'm glad to have you on to talk about this episode for sure. I want to give out the phone number because we're happy to have the switchboard back up and running after a couple weeks of it being down during the holidays. Thanks to the engineers for getting that taken care of. The number, if you want to call and participate, is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 if you want to be on the show. Push 1 if you want to be brought onto the show. We have a bunch of people who have called in. Nobody's pushed 1 yet. So there won't be a long wait if you choose to be on the show and you push 1. You can also participate or contribute via email. You can send the email to wadekellerpodcast@gmail.com. Please note that change. It's not at PWTorch anymore. It's at Gmail. wadekellerpodcast@gmail.com if you'd like to ask a question or just give your point of view on the show. So let's just keep rolling here with the show, Brandon, and get to Adam Cole's promo about the devil, being the devil. Tony Schiavone stressing this was a long arc to get to where they are. They plotted for a very long time. Did this tie up loose ends, make sense, amplify things that should have been amplified in terms of the journey and then the landing place with this group, Brandon? So that first, and then from there we'll also talk about if we just like the group and like the prospects of them. But first and foremost, did this promo from Adam Cole, he pretty much spoke exclusively, did it make sense?
I thought it mostly made sense. I didn't particularly care for it. I mean, I thought it was delivered well. I thought, you know, he laid out the groundwork and the mission statement well enough. I mean, it was, you know, as far as presentation, it was just fine. But I just feel like there is a carryover in the lingering disappointment that befell the devil angle. And the length of time that it went on without a resolution. And I think that very clearly right out of the gate, you're seeing already sort of the issues and challenges that are presented by having the devil be revealed as someone who is on the shelf and presumably will be for a significant period of time. I mean, the only plausible payoff to this angle is an MJF and Adam Cole match, and with MJF presumably now taking some time off and Adam Cole, you know, already in the midst of a long layoff, it seems like they're going to have to do a lot of heavy lifting to carry this angle through to see its logical conclusion. And I just don't feel like it's got the gas on night one, let alone what could be months and months away.
Yeah. I mean, to have the devil payoff occur on a show that transitions to a stretch of time where MJF's not, after the angle felt like it was dragged out because of Adam Cole's injury and trying to get to the World's End pay-per-view. Yeah. And I mean, you know, as Shivani said, it was an elaborate plan that took, as he put it, a long, long time. And I mean, ought to have been wrapped up earlier. I know we sort of had the this is your life, Adam Cole, this is your life, devil and your henchman group, with the different people coming out who affected them, who they attacked. And so in that sense, I mean, they did cover those bases, but it also did something that I think it's a problem in AEW, because I think what they're doing is less effective. There's a lot of wrestlers who fans don't know how to feel about them. I mean, they think they're cool, they're good, they have good matches, but they're not like passionately in. It's like, you know, it's like me watching a Cowboys Giants game. I mean, I don't like either of them, and then whatever. I mean, if it's good football, I'll watch, but I'm not emotionally invested in the win or loss like I am if my Minnesota Vikings are playing.
Yeah.
So, or the Green Bay Packers, I want to see them lose. You know, and that emotional investment isn't there the way they're presenting this. Are we supposed to like Jay White now? Was Max Caster showing a temper last week? Like, are we supposed to ignore that, or is that something that also there's just all these characters with mixed where I think the average viewer has mixed feelings about them, and I think it leads to the worst thing in wrestling, which is ambivalence. It's not like, you know, the dueling chant of let's go Cena sucks, which, by the way, is inferior to everyone cheering or everyone booing Cena, but it is not a horrible, you know, secondary result of having a big part of your audience reject the way you're framing one of your top acts, if they're enthusiastically into them pro or con. But there's not a lot of that going on here. You know, people like Jay White, but they don't love him. And some people dislike Jay White, but they don't hate him. And then you put him out there up against, you know, speaking out against the devil and his henchmen. And it's like, well, I don't know how I feel right now. I'm just watching people argue who I don't have strong feelings pro or con with. And I thought there was just a little bit too much of that on the show. You know, Tony Storm's a heel, but then Mariah May is a heel, but Tony Storm doesn't want to give Mariah May the time of day. You know, there's just example after example. People love Swerve Strickland. They kind of get a kick out of Prince Nana. But fans are into Prince Nana. They're into Swerve Strickland. So now you're undercutting Garcia's momentum by putting him in the ring in a main event against a heel who fans like, and having him go at it with a heel manager in a sports entertainment-y comedy spot. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yes, Tony Khan, you're good at hiring wrestlers who are good wrestlers and matching them in the ring. You're making matches and they're good, but that's like the easy part, and that's not being a booker. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of, you know, move throughout the show in certain ways, but to have the parade of people come out and react, it's good in the sense that they were all affected by it. But in terms of how much time they gave it, and that being kind of the main emphasis, or one of the main emphases of this opening devil group storyline, is rough. The other thing, and then I'll throw it back to you, Brandon, is it's sort of like the criticism of Bullet Club Gold. Jay White, serious person. Juice Robinson, goofball comedy act.
Yep.
And the Guns, you know, they were portrayed as mid-card AEW dark wrestlers. I touted them. I think they're good. I think they, you know, they were underrated for a long time, and they take great bumps, and there's a lot of assets, but they're not serious people in the way that they've been presented. So you've got a leader and three clowns. You know, you've got Jeff Jarrett in the clown show. Now you've got this major storyline with the Devil, and you have Matt Taven and Mike Bennett, who just they act like they're laughing at inside jokes or middle school humor constantly. They're not serious people. Roderick Strong has been a comedy figure, faking an injury and yelling out names. And now they're three out of the four henchmen with the Devil. We're supposed to take this group seriously. You know, Arn and Tully were not comedy figures in the Four Horsemen. And that's what made it a great group. You know, the Usos are a serious tag team, not comedy figures. Solo Sikoa is here. You look at faction, even JD McDonagh is a more serious person in the Judgment Day, along with Rhea Ripley and everybody is, than Taven, Bennett, and Strong. So I have my issues with that, and I spoke about that in the last few weeks, that if, you know, Adam Cole and I was thinking Britt Baker might be part of this, and Wardlow would be in a faction, I wasn't crazy about Strong, Taven, and Bennett also being in it, because either they have to act unnatural and, frankly, kind of boring without doing what their natural personalities are, which is, again, looking like they're laughing at a dirty joke in sixth grade. It's hard to take them seriously. So I think that defines the group down. So I threw a lot out there. Brandon, take it away. React to any of that.
Yeah, that was one of my primary concerns going in as soon as the reveal happened on Saturday night. It's Adam Cole, who has spent the better part of the last year playing, you know, buddy comedy with MJF, and all of these henchmen who were involved in just ridiculous one-note slapstick comedy for the better part of the year. And now suddenly you're supposed to take them seriously as a top faction in the company when there's more factions already than I can count. And so many of them suffer from this exact same issue, which you outlined already with Bullet Club Gold. They have one guy who is to be taken seriously, and then the rest of them are just mid-card or worse, lower mid-card fodder who have not been presented with any semblance of seriousness whatsoever. And that's what you have here. It's very quickly right out of the gate something that they are going to be fighting an uphill battle on. And I made this argument with Greg on Saturday on Wrestling Night in America. AEW is starting in a lot of ways to resemble that period of time in WWE where they were fighting the tide against the audience constantly because they just can't seem to get their story straight on who is a heel and who is a babyface. Or at the very least, they can't seem to define them well enough in a way that gets people emotionally invested in characters and in matches. And I use the example on Saturday of that Abaddon and Julia Hart match where it was a fine match, but there was no investment in it overall because at the end of the day, the crowd wasn't invested in the characters themselves. They were invested in the idea that this is spooky. And that's what got over during the course of that match. There's so much of that in AEW right now where the crowd is just cheering good wrestling and not actually investing in what is happening. And that's great for, you know, star ratings and for an enjoyable 2 hours of television. But I think as we've seen, it's not great for ticket sales. It's not great for ratings. It's just not great for the overall outlook. And you had that up and down this show, and in particular in that opening segment.
Yep. Well put. Well put. I also, in looking at this segment, you know, when we think about like this group having gravitas and fans being – first, you're going to have the issue of fans being angry at Cole. So I want to give credit. They played his music briefly, then cut it off and went to other music. So if Adam Cole turns babyface, which better not be until 2026 because AEW turns too many people too often. But when that music plays again – that's, you know, it'll get a big pop if they get there. But Adam Cole has been an earnest, somewhat naive, cartoonish, you know, almost cartoonishly naive, wide-eyed buddy pal with MJF. And to pivot to the sinister mastermind, I wanted a little more explanation from him about when he was sincere and when he wasn't. Was it like, and maybe I have to rewatch the promo to pick up on this, but I don't think he made it really clear at what point was the friendship sincere and what wasn't. He said a lot of general things negative about MJF and his trustworthiness and his selfishness. But I wanted to hear him say, did you really think I was a slave doing chores for 3 weeks at Roderick Strong's house? Of course not. We were partying and drinking for all those weeks, and then we'd film these segments to, and you were gullible and you bought it, and so did you fans. Like, I want them to walk us through every step of it and explain this master plan and how it was executed. Or I want him to say, yeah, for a while there, guys, I wasn't really happy with how you treated me, but the longer that I was around you, and the more things you said about MJF, they started to sink in with me. So it opened my eyes, and then I noticed once I got out of the house and I'm in rehab and I'm watching on television and I'm talking to people and I'm noticing when you text me and when you don't, you're a selfish person. And then that's when I decided that you weren't really my friend and that you were just using me. We didn't get that explanation. Maybe they think it's inherent in it in terms of what he said tonight. Brandon, what do you think in that regard? Were you looking for more? Do you think they did enough? Or do you think they don't even know? Because the more they explain, the more there might be holes in the logic.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly didn't do enough. And I don't know that I ever expected them to do enough, because the logic of it sort of had to fall by the wayside to some extent once Cole got hurt and they decided to continue to commit to it. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that Adam Cole actually did aid MJF in retaining the title multiple times over the course of several months while the devil was, you know, doing his thing. So we're now supposed to believe that because Cole struck some sort of deal with Samoa Joe, he was okay with Joe beating MJF, except that he didn't aid Joe in beating MJF at all. I mean, it's such a leap there. And so there was never anything they could really do to have done enough. I have to imagine that the plan was for it to be Cole who beats MJF and that,
right,
becomes,
right,
the reveal. I mean, otherwise there's just no way to make it make sense. And so I raised this concern on Wrestling Night in America with Greg, and I just said, you know, given how poorly the devil angle had been received after so much time, given the Adam Cole injury, given how well Cole and MJF got over together as babyfaces, I would have pivoted and gone with someone else as the devil.
Yeah.
Because even if it was disappointing, I think you could have made more sense. And then you could have given the time and effort and care that I think the MJF and Adam Cole breakup deserved rather than what this became.
And I think – I don't want to give them a mulligan, but it is worth saying there's an asterisk next to any criticism, which is they got some curveballs thrown at them, mainly Adam Cole's injury. So, and then MJF's injury too. And so, they may have had something that would make more sense, or that they could connect more dots than they did. I like the idea of Cole saying, you know, I helped you extend your title reign because, well, I had a deal with Joe. You know, once I hurt my knee – that, you know, he was going to be the one who took you out. And, you know, think it through. And if they plan this out 6 weeks ago, they can create some storyline support for what Cole sat down and said tonight.
But then Joe beat him clean.
Well, right, but that's my point. Is like, you tell a six-week story that culminates in something at World's End. And maybe that includes Adam Cole going, you know what? I was ready to interfere if I thought you were going to beat Joe. You didn't need my that big of a badass. Whatever. You know, but basically, think of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And cover your ass. Cover your bases. And I don't think they did. So I just, you know what I mean? If somebody can call in or write a letter and an email and say, hey, I think they did. You're missing this and this and this. And that's happened to me before. And this is a layered, complex, long, as Tony Schiavone said, storyline. Maybe somebody thinks they did a better job in that regard than I feel they did tonight. Or maybe the argument is, And in a way, you're making it, Brandon. There's no way to save this. Like, if you go down the route of, oh, I was planning this all along, and of course I wasn't that idiot doing chores for 3 weeks at Roderick Strong's house, that's not who I was. Because you sort of want to disown that, because it's kind of hard to take him seriously ever again after that cartoon, that whole cartoon world we were exposed to for weeks. So you say that's fake, but then why is Cole helping MJF retain the title? And so if you line up the timeline on this, you know, either explaining it or even more so skewering it for how ridiculous it is. But AEW should hold themselves to a high standard. You want the payoff to be, like, really satisfying. And there's just a lot of things about this that aren't. Now, ultimately, the idea was, I was sort of saying this in the VIP roundtable with Todd and Rich on Saturday, maybe things aren't going to make sense in every way, but you just need to turn the page and start the year going, hey, we kind of blew that, or we changed our mind on this, or that injury screwed things up, or two injuries screwed things up. Just at least start out of the gate strong. And that's where, you know, maybe trying to explain things that can't make sense is drawing attention to things that you just want to move on from. And maybe that was their approach, which is not ideal, to say the least. But that might have been a conscious decision on their part to not get too bogged down. And they thought, if we just at least have the people who were attacked by the devil in his henchmen come out and yell at them, we're at least covering those bases. And that's more important than the timing of when Cole decided and whether it's consistent with his actions along the way.
Yeah, I just think it's going to be so hard to maintain any real sort of momentum when Adam Cole is not facing the guy who he screwed over that the crowd has built such an affinity for. Because this, again, goes back to that issue of them not clearly defining roles and the crowd not being invested in characters, but rather just people they like. I mean, yeah, Adam Cole just did this dastardly deed, but when Cole is facing a babyface, are they going to boo him? Because that hasn't been the case up to now. I mean, Adam Cole has been almost universally cheered since he showed up in AEW, and that's why I've argued so strongly for just letting him be a babyface, because people are going to cheer him. They like him. It's just like Swerve Strickland right now. Swerve Strickland is as dastardly and evil as they come, and he's getting cheered, and when he's beating down a beloved veteran babyface and kicking him in the head, the crowd is chanting one more time. So who's to say that they're going to be able to sustain any sort of negative reaction with Cole?
Pro wrestling doesn't need to be a morality play, but there should be some structure to it where universally throughout the show, all the characters, the announcers, how everybody acts and reacts, there's a baseline of conduct that is considered fair or unfair. And you see that in sports, you know, on the offensive line, if you can get away with holding, good for you. If you get caught, there's a penalty. But you can't go after the quarterback's head with your helmet. You can't go after somebody's knee and tear their knee ligaments. That's auto line. And then you don't want the announcers seeing a dirty player do what would be considered a dirty move in a game and have the announcers go, well, you do what you got to do to win. The stakes are high. No, of course, you would decry that. You would be critical of it. And AEW doesn't do that. And so what you have is a breakdown in how the fans perceive this presentation of a simulated sport, and they don't react naturally to things that happen that in other companies over the decades the tone was set. The fan base is conditioned, if not indoctrinated, into seeing things through a certain lens. You know, and Bill Watts would do that on color commentary. Jim Cornette would do it on color commentary. When they were booking their company, they had that strong set of here's what's okay, here's what's not, and when a line is crossed, they're outraged. And the reason fans are cheering Swerve despite invading Hangman's house is they don't take that stuff seriously. Because it goes further than it should in wrestling. You know, wrestling shouldn't go into home invasion territory, ever. And if you want to have people get immersed and believe things that are more grounded in what happens in the arenas. But if you do it and it's not like the biggest story of the year and it's all you talk about, but instead you sort of move on from it. Again, fans are conditioned to not take it real seriously, and then they react to who's cool, who has a cool catchphrase, who has something that's silly. It's not good for Danny Garcia's career that fans are encouraging him to do his hip swivel. It's the most over thing he's ever done, but it's stunting what his potential is because it's such a cartoonish, nonsense, degrading, silly lower card thing.
And when he did that tonight, it reduced him to Nana's level, not Swerve's level.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think he's like, oh, well, it's over. The crowd's cheering. Well, yeah, but they're sort of laughing at you, not with you. And when they react to that, what they're doing is they're sending a message to you. We see you as the clown, entertain us with juggling. They don't see you as a serious wrestler. And so to me, people encouraging you to do that is a bad sign for your upward mobility on the roster. Because he's so talented, and I think he's very relatable. I think he connects with the crowd in a way that's underrated by most people that I hear talk about him. And I think there's potential for him to be, you know, a top of the second tier player. But
the promo was good, too.
I know. That's a thing. And, you know, he can visit that top tier and be a credible opponent or gatekeeper, a sympathetic babyface who heels get heat by beating up. But, you know, he's a level or two below that because he's doing this silly dance. So when you talk about Adam Cole and the fans cheering him, yeah, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough. And what you don't want, though, is fans not cheering him anymore because he degraded himself with bad slapstick comedy for months. And then it's part of a storyline that's so uncool in the end because he has, you know, three clowns standing behind him as supposedly badasses now, trying to pretend that they're not clowns. And that's three-fifths of his group and three-fourths of the henchmen. And then you have the other negative, which is he's going to copy the Christian kill switch storyline. With, you know, like, oh, you can have the title Wardlow until I'm ready to take it from you, and you should then hand it to me. Like, it's basically a copy of that. It might be like a good idea in isolation, but you're doing that in another part of your show. So therefore, you cannot do it. You shouldn't be hinting at a breakup on the first promo you do in
right.
the group.
It's the first night, and they're already teasing dissension.
Exactly. And the reason they did it, I get it. It's, well, Adam Cole's the leader of the group. So he's the one who is the centerpiece of the storyline. So he's got to assert that he's not just a manager. You know, might be a little insecurity there, given the Vince McMahon stuff. He's not just a spokesperson. He wants to be the alpha once he's ready. I get that they want to say that, but I would have avoided it. I would have let that be what people think is a possibility before I would immediately basically telegraph, we're not going to be together for long. AEW turns way too many people way too often. Todd Martin talks about that a lot, and rightfully so. They've already started turning either Cole or Wardlow on each other. Mm-hmm. On the first promo, because they were focused on, we want Cole to be the alpha, or perceived as that, and I think the price they paid in that opening promo was too great. I strongly disagree with introducing now. You don't want people to think, oh, I'm going to get invested in this new group, and then immediately think, oh, they're not for long. Anything else on that, Brent?
Oh, you didn't like it going in, and you just convinced me to like it even less.
Fair enough. All right, our number, give us a call, 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1, as Keith in Virginia did. You are up. What are your thoughts on Dynamite? You can talk about what we've talked about already, or plenty of things that we haven't got to yet. Happy New Year.
Well, I have a lot of different thoughts. I guess I'll have to pick out which ones. I'll offer that pushback on some of the stuff that you were saying. I think I like the show quite a bit more than you did. I think that's pretty safe to say. Let's see. I guess the last thing you were talking about was Wardlow and Adam Cole. I agree that it is a copy of the whole Christian thing, and I wasn't thinking about that at the time. However, I don't think they were at all teasing dissension. I think the dissension that we see coming is because we know what's coming. They were at all at odds. He said, he's going to surrender the title to me, and Wardlow said, yeah, I definitely am. He's shaking his head. So I think
did you look at how he shook his head yes? I mean, I think Wardlow's pretty good with his subtle acting, more than he is at just solo promos. And I think that was someone sort of reluctantly going, I guess that's my role. Maybe I will. I better say I will. But Brandon, how did you read into Wardlow's face? Did you think
I, Yeah. I took it sarcastically. Like, he was nodding sarcastically.
Yeah, like, yeah, that's what you think, Adam Cole, but I'm not, don't be so sure about it. But go ahead, Keith. I mean, if you saw that differently, yeah. And I don't think it's for sure that Brandon and I are right and you're wrong. But if Wardlow's like, I'm happy to hand you the title, I don't even think that's believable either. I mean, that's just, but it is, it's not a copy of Christian Luchasaurus. It's just too similar to it. You know, I think there are going to be slight differences. It's just too similar to do at the same time. Plus, as I said, day one, first promo, you're already putting out there a trope that's been done in wrestling, and that's what people are going to be thinking about and waiting for now, as opposed to solidifying the group for 9 to 18 months first before you introduce that, which is what you ought to do. But go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely get what you're saying, and it makes a whole lot of sense. I probably would have opted not to do it, but I definitely – and I was, kind of looking for it, so I guess it depends on how – went across with people. I was thinking, oh, okay, Wardlow is going to give this, yeah, right, like, get it again. Moving on to, you have a great point about AEW being unable to clearly define their characters. However, in certain instances, I have less of a problem with it in the details of it, such as Bullet Club Gold. The thing is, Juice Robinson is kind of a goofball, and the guns are kind of goofy also. But I don't think that's a problem because nobody thinks they're good guys yet. Nobody thought they were good guys yet until tonight's events. So when they're flipping, it seems they're going babyface. We can now look at them in a different light because when they were acting goofy, you never thought they wouldn't beat you up. You just thought they're goofy but Jay White was never as goofy as the rest of them. And he provided a contrast, kind of like, what was the other group you guys were, there was Swerve. I don't think they have as big a problem as you guys think they do yet because people are loving Swerve regardless of the fact that he's a heel. And for now, that's okay because he's consistent. He's not a good guy. He does evil things. At some point, they're going to have to address how people feel about him, but we're not there yet. And it's okay to not quite be there yet.
But if you listen to Keith, if you listen to my criticism of this, it is not that it's a problem to have fans cheering a heel in and of itself. It's that it is consistently unfair to the baby faces that they wrestle. Because if you have someone who's over, you're like, yeah, he's over. Heel or face, however you portray him. If fans are really into him, yeah, that's better than not caring about him. But my criticism focuses primarily on the effect it has on undercutting the baby faces, which is my issue with Blackpool Combat Club being booked against babyfaces. Fans like them. So even though they're mostly heels, I think they see themselves mostly as heels in real life, although Bryan Danielson isn't consistent in that way because he's just Bryan Danielson and it's all kind of, well, whatever, that's a whole other issue. It's unfair to Danny Garcia. You're trying to get him over as a babyface, and now you've got fans cheering for Swerve. Same thing with Hangman Page now. If you have a heel who's mega popular and fans are cheering, I don't want to be next in line to face him if I'm a top-level babyface like Hangman. I mean, they can fight the headwind all they want, but you're fighting a headwind. You're putting energy into something that's not going to get the desired result, and you know it going in. So do something different. And this feels stubborn. Not only that, just sort of stale, having them go at it again. But that's a separate issue. But go ahead, Keith. I just want to clarify that it's fine to have it's fine in theory to have a wrestler who's over – who's technically a heel, but fans are cheering, except for the inevitable side effect of it completely undercutting the baby faces they wrestle.
Right. And
which is why tweeters don't work 9 out of 10 times. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I totally agree about the Blackpool Combat Club. I do not understand that those are smart guys, why they're doing what they're doing, the way they're doing it. I really don't understand it. And I agree that AEW has an overall problem with that. This is in certain instances. Take Danny Garcia. I don't see I understand why people like him, and I think that he can be something one day, but I think that day is a long time from now. And for now, him being defined as not quite on that level is okay, because I don't think he's quite on that level. When he didn't turn on Jericho, he didn't see the light. He just went back to where he was. And after that, I was kind of like, let him do it.
Keith, you're right. You know, that was huge. I want to underline, though, the issue isn't that Danny Garcia should be a main eventer right now. That's not, and it seems to be what you're rebutting. It's like, it's okay for him to not be at the level he's at. I'm fine with the level he's at, but my specific criticism is the dance is going to lower the ceiling on where he can go, because people are seeing him as mid-card comedy as opposed to a young, serious athlete on the rise who's relatable and personable and fans connect with on a level. They have too many people on that roster, men and women, who aren't serious people. And that's why I like Joe. That's one of the problems with MJF when he was doing the kangaroo kick. Got a reaction, but he's a world champion. Is that really the direction you want him to be going in? So, again, the key isn't, Danny should be a main eventer right now. Garcia shouldn't be. But having his thing be a dance is completely defining him down compared to where he could be, because you're going for the dopamine rush of a viral video GIF and fans popping and chanting and reacting to something that I would say displaces the journey to the top that he might otherwise be successful at being on, which might take two more years to get there. But now I don't know that it's possible.
Right. And I wonder what they can, like, do they make a clean break? How do they fix all these little problems that go in that direction? Like, Nana, don't do the dance anymore. Danny, don't do the dance anymore. Tony, we're just going to make you, Tony Storm, clear-cut evil. I mean, how do you pull that Band-Aid off? Because they have so much of that going on, I'm wondering. And I'll let you guys get back to the show, and thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Sure thing. Yeah, thanks, Keith. Brandon, what do you think about that? I mean, obviously you can say, well, if you plan a year ahead, you ease your way away from some of these things, try to minimize the damage, and start introducing characters with this stuff in mind. I guess that would be my answer, is it's a bit of a journey because some of the damage is done and some wheels are in motion. What do you think?
I mean, I think you have to be water to some extent. You have to be willing to pivot when the audience dictates that you do so. And I don't necessarily mean that you let the audience influence every single character arc and direction that you take. But when there is an obvious wave building and a tide turning on a character, and it's sustained for a significant period of time, I think that in order to just get the house in order, that you just lean into it. Because otherwise, you're risking doing damage to other characters, like you mentioned with Swerve and Hangman. Like, I think at this point, we've seen enough evidence to suggest that this is not a fad with Swerve Strickland. The crowd is into this character. They are into Prince Nana. They want to do the dance. They like the theme song. They love who Swerve is in the ring. And I think you just go with it. And that doesn't mean completely changing who Swerve is as a character. That just means pivoting ever so slightly so that he is not quite as vicious or as violent, that he shakes Danny Garcia's hand tonight because he respects the fight that Danny Garcia brought, and that he's doing the things that he's doing to heels instead of baby faces. I think that's an easy fix. You just lean into what the crowd wants because it's clear that it's not going to change anytime soon. I think you do the same thing with someone like Tony Storm. The character is over. They've managed to finally hit on something significant in the women's division, which they've struggled mightily to do for almost the promotion's entire existence. I think you take a look at the situation that they found themselves in Saturday at World's End as a perfect example of just getting themselves into a bad situation because they wouldn't – they were too stubborn to listen to what the fans were clearly telling them, and that is that Toni Storm is their girl right now. So don't put her in the ring against an underdog babyface because it's going to backfire against Riho, and that's not fair to Riho.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly. Do you think Prince Nana works with Strickland, period, if Strickland's going to be a top player? And does it work better as a babyface Strickland? And even though babyface managers are rare, they're rare. I'll stick with that. Or not. How do you feel about that?
I think it can work. I mean, I think that it can – I don't know that Nana can be quite as over the top as he is right now, but I think that they could still make it work. And I also think that you'd have to play it by ear, because I think that if you do pivot and you have Swerve go babyface, I think that opens the door at least a little bit for him to show a little bit more personality during his entrance, for example. Now, I don't want Swerve to be doing the full Nana dance. You know, I don't want him to come out and turn into that kind of character. But if you saw Swerve, for example, he was involved with some Jaguars promotional material last week or the week before. It was around Christmas time. And they played Big Pressure at Everbank Stadium, at the Jags Stadium. And Swerve entered onto the field with the Jags cheerleaders. And he did a really subdued version of the Nana dance. And it looked cool. It looked like something that he would do, that his character would do. He didn't lean all the way into it, but it worked within the confines for who he is. I think there's room for him to open up a little bit in that respect. So if he were to do that, I think I'd have to see what Nana looks like beside that version of Swerve.
What I'd also like AEW to establish for their audience is, what is Prince Nana's role as it relates to Swerve Strickland? What does he bring to the table? How does he serve Swerve Strickland?
Right.
Because what he is he likes to sing "We're in the Money" with a very self-satisfied, you know, sing-song expression, as if it's the most clever thing that's ever been done. And he does the silly dance. That seems to be something that Swerve Strickland would roll his eyes at, based on how I see Swerve Strickland, not that he would find endearing or helpful to the task at hand, which is to become world champion. So again, you have things that are cute and fun, which has its place in most pro wrestling companies, to be honest. But does that type of act belong with someone who has unexpectedly been buoyed to main event level by the fan base? Or do you look for an adjustment, either to Nana's character or splitting him off in a different direction? I just don't understand what Prince Nana does to serve Swerve Strickland. As an AEW viewer, why are they together? How does Nana help Swerve? If it's Swerve wants him around because he's a lackey who will help him win matches when he's outmatched by a babyface, we'll tell that story. The announcers need to hit those notes, and they need to say, Prince Nana's not a serious person. He's a clown. Swerve Strickland doesn't need him. But when he's matched up against a babyface who he knows in his heart, or he fears in his heart he can't beat clean, he puts up with this clown because he knows he'll interfere on his behalf or create a distraction. Well, then tell that story. Toni Schiavone should have that as a constitution of the dynamic between these two, and it should be ingrained in everybody, Renee and the interviewers and the announcers, and that should be the story they tell about them. But it's not established. It's just sort of, oh, Nana's this colorful, quirky, cult popular figure doing goofy stuff, and Swerve has a catchphrase that fans like to chant. That's the surface-level stuff, and it's not top-level booking. It's not top-level character development. And I think it's limiting, and then you end up with crowds being more into ironically chanting or counter-chanting things instead of being invested in him as a top act. And it is one of the things that modern WWE gets right when it comes to their top people. And I don't see evidence that it even crosses Tony Khan's mind that that's a thing that he's ever thought about as important. And I think that's limiting AEW's growth.
Yeah, and it's an extension, too, of the many, many factions without explanation or without reason. I mean, the yep. Mughal embassy is one of those things. I mean, how rarely do we see the full Mughal embassy on TV at this? Brian Cage is part of it, but he just came out in a match tonight and no mention of the Mughal embassy. I mean, like, they only seem to mention it when Swerve needs numbers. Otherwise, there's no mention, there's no definition, there's no, you know, clearly defined glue that holds this group together. And it's been like that since the beginning.
Yeah. Yep. So, I don't know. I'm watching Swerve, I'm watching Nana, and I'm like, it's fine where it was, but it's not fine where they want to take it. And I don't think Prince Nana is unsalvageable. But I think sometimes you need to sacrifice something that's fun, kind of like the Garcia dance, in order to go from being a clown or an unserious act that is mid-card levity and adjust and maybe skip something that's kind of fun and over with the crowd in a mid-card way in order to elevate your act to something more serious. And I think the top managers over the years have taken that approach. You know, I mean, we knew what purpose Jim Cornette served for the Midnight Express. He was a spoiled rich brat who liked wrestling, and his mom gave him a lot of money to hire wrestlers, and he was good at managing their travel and letting them go kick ass. And that story was told not often enough when he moved from one promotion to another, but that was the core genesis of his character. And Bobby Heenan served a purpose with Nick Bockwinkel and his guys. Gary Hart absolutely served a purpose for Kabuki and the people that he managed in World Class Championship Wrestling and WCW with Great Muda. They were serious people. J.J. Dillon managed. He was the guy who was going and pouring over spreadsheets at 11 o'clock at night while Ric Flair and Tully and Arn and Barry or whoever went out partying. Like you understood there was a dynamic, there was a relationship, there was a symbiotic mutual benefit to them being together. And I just don't think Tony Khan and people in AEW and frankly a lot of the wrestlers who grew up in a more modern era where this stuff hasn't been focused on, to say the least, I think Paul Levesque is a student of this. I think Paul Heyman is a student of that. And that's why you see that showing up more now in WWE with their influence. Heyman's over the Bloodline and Levesque over the larger product. And we saw it in NXT also when he was in charge of that. Shawn Michaels seems less into that. And NXT's a little bit off that track because of it. And you can kind of, you know, tell wrestlers, the way wrestlers are presented and managers and how announcers call things does end up being reflective of the philosophy and frankly, how the knowledge base that bookers bring to the product. And Tony Khan is a product of the adrenaline rush, crash TV, two shows on at the same time. Every minute counts. We want to see what kind of viewership drop there is during a commercial break. And the most important thing is figuring out a way to get 20% more people to hang out during a commercial break. And it's like, no, that's small ball. Big thing is, how do we get characters over that are stars, larger than life, that have a defined constitution, and get fans to pop for the falls, not just get into chanting, this is awesome, fight forever, you effed up, which is rude, stop doing that, people, and reacting because they're invested in who wins and who loses. And I want to see AEW go that route, and frankly, tonight, if this was supposed to be turning the page to a more sports-like presentation and less sports entertainment-y stuff, I don't know. I think you could drop this show into the middle of October and no one would go, whoa, something's different than it was last week or next week.
No.
Did you notice anything in that regard, Brandon?
No, I didn't think that it was that large of a pivot. I mean, it felt like a different show in that, you know, the talent featured was different because they were they were shorthanded in a way because of Wrestle Kingdom and because of injuries and just who they chose to you know put on the show. But yeah, other than that, it didn't feel to me like a significant departure.
Yeah. All right, I want to get to email from JB from Detroit here. He's got a five-part email. One, my favorite part of the Undisputed Kingdom's opening segment is I actually had a clear mission statement. It wasn't just meaningless platitudes. The fact that each member will be seeking or defending gold, much like the Continental Classic, could work to give Dynamite better structure starting in 2024. I hope the stable will tell adequate stories until Adam Cole can fully return to the ring. So, yes, however, there's too many titles in AEW. And so you're bragging about ROH titles, and you're talking about the international title. There's just too many championships. So it's like, we're going to go after titles. Well, yeah, but the titles are all watered down because there's too many of them. And now we have the Continental Crown to go with the international and the TNT as you know, secondary titles to the men's world title. So they have a mission statement, but it's kind of a generic mission statement. You know, I mean, it's better than, I guess, not having one, but isn't that everybody's mission? I mean, almost in the top 2/3 of the roster. Doesn't everybody want to win titles? So I'm not quite sure that's a mission statement more as much as it is stating the obvious, which would be inherent in why anybody is there.
Yeah, Brad, that was one of my big issues with tonight's show was you add a new title to the pantheon of championships that are defended across AEW and Ring of Honor, and you immediately on night one you essentially set the table for what this championship is going to be, and it's four lower mid-card acts. And so right out of the gate, you essentially get to what my worst fear with this thing was the whole time, and why I said this on Wrestling Night in America with Greg Parks on Saturday, that as much as I enjoyed the wrestling in the Continental Classic, I sat through that entire tournament trying to reconcile my enjoyment for the matches themselves with, at the same time, feeling like I had to root against the guys who I thought would be best to win a tournament because I knew that at the end they would be saddled with a championship that was going to mean nothing. And I got some pushback for that because, you know, people said, well, this one could presumably be different. But AEW's history dictated that it wouldn't be. I mean, that's just how they've been with these championships. And I feel vindicated on night one, but I don't want to be. I mean, I wanted to be wrong. I wanted this championship to be different. I wanted it to be the one that only gets defended once a year during the Continental Classic. But instead, it's just one that we've already established a number one contender for, and it's going to be defended on a throwaway episode of Collision. Why did Trent Barretta or anyone in that four-way match deserve an opportunity at this championship before any of the guys who put up multiple points during the course of the tournament? It's senseless. I mean, yes, I agree that it's good that wrestlers are declaring that they're coming after a championship, but that doesn't mean all that much when there's enough championships for half the roster to have one. And the number just keeps growing.
Yeah, I was just so disappointed that they put a very random group of four wrestlers in the ring and then just treated it like they did on any other given week, a TNT or a national title match or the women's titles. You know, it's like, oh, we just got this random match. The announcers can't even really justify, you know, why these four were chosen. And then it's like, it's Trent Barretta. Like that's your vaunted triple crown. Is first challenger is a guy who wins a four way against three other randos basically. And it sounds disrespectful to the individual wrestlers, but like rando in the sense of why them others. And they're talented and they had a good match. But that's, again, it's just, that's not booking. That's not major national cable level sophisticated booking. You're like, well, it'll be a good match. You've got to have something more to it. And if it's just because, well, we have too many titles to have a sensible story about why people earn title shots, then get rid of titles. The answer isn't have a bunch of randos in multi-person matches and then not even a mid-card singles wrestler, a mid-card tag wrestler. It's the first challenger? I mean, talk about setting the tone. Just don't have Kingston defend it ever or not for, like just have it be – I mean, I would have rather it been a trophy. And then there's a tournament next year. It's kind of like the diamond ring. But the last thing they needed is just another, you know, Xerox of the TNT International title. So, I mean, I'm bummed about that, and it certainly doesn't feel prestigious. I was thinking, well, they're going to have equal titles. This is going to – because of the grueling nature of the tournament and the quality of the competition, although certainly the depth of the tournament in terms of main event wrestlers with winning records could have been higher. And they had their reasons. I get it, but it doesn't change the outcome, which is there were some mid-carder and low-card guys in there who had no chance to win, and people saw them as just designated losers, and they were. But I thought, oh, maybe the Triple Crown title, now Continental Crown, will end up being the major title on Collision. And the AEW World Champion would be on Dynamite. It would be part of a brand separation, if not a split. And nope, that's not it. It's just one of three secondary titles that at various times may or may not feel very important. We just put up a 20 years ago house show report. It was John Cena challenging Big Show for the U.S. title on PWTorch.com. And our correspondent, it was 20 years ago this week, a correspondent said, I forgot the U.S. title even existed. Because there was that stretch of time Big Show had it, and it just wasn't talked about or brought up on TV for a long time. There's a history of secondary titles not being given attention. AEW has three of them on, 5 hours of TV a week, and it's just a shortcut booking crutch that's watering down the major singles championship. And I can live with one major title and one secondary title, but not four men's titles in the same ecosystem with no differentiation between them other than there's one major one and then three secondary ones that on any given month might feel more important than the other two.
But wait, it isn't even just that, because there's the ROH World title, there's the ROH TV title, there's the ROH Pure title, there's the New Japan Strong title. I mean, there.
Well, two of them are wrapped up in this now.
Sure. But presumably they won't be forever, I'm guessing.
Maybe not,
If ROH is going to continue to run pay-per-views, you would assume that they're going to have a world title. So
sorry, Brandon. Even if you say that New Japan Strong and the ROH TV title are merged into this, you still have, as you said, the Pure title and the FTW title.
Oh, yeah. And
unsanctioned, but it's defended on AEW pay-per-views. So there's no difference, even if they say it's unsanctioned or unrecognized.
And isn't it the ROH world title that's wrapped up?
Oh, yeah. So there's the TV title. One of the ROH titles is separate and one is combined in this. So either way, there's an ROH singles title and an FTW title going along with this title. And the new – go ahead. Make your point. I wasn't trying to undercut your point as much as just going, there's this meaningless title.
Right.
Meaningless is on overstatement. There's another secondary title lost in the mix. That's actually three titles in one that does not make it more important when Trent Barreto wins a four-way rando match to become the first challenger.
And the other two weren't important prior to. So,
right.
I mean, it makes it even worse, too, when one of them is your feeder system's world title. I mean, now you have Trent Barreto challenging for the ROH World Championship. I mean, how does that make any sense? Not only is it setting the Continental Classic, this Continental title, off on the wrong foot, it's sending the wrong message about the Continental Classic for next year, which I thought was a really good positive for them in a down month. It's already sending the message that, hey, this is defined down. So now you're limiting who theoretically should be taking spots in this tournament next year, because it already feels way below Jon Moxley. It feels below Bryan Danielson. It feels below Jay White. So now it feels below Swerve Strickland. So who are you going to put in next year where it's not going to feel like a waste of time for them to be competing in? And it doesn't even begin to cover the fact that you've got all of these other championships floating around out there, not just in the men's singles division, but then the tag team titles as well, because it's not just the AEW tag team titles. It's the ROH tag titles.
What if instead of the four-way match with four randos, what if Miro stepped up, came out with CJ and said, I want this Continental Classic Championship? Miro feels like a top-tier guy. He feels like he's on house arrest 7 out of 8 weeks, and he sends in promos from home, and then he gets furloughed or whatever the term would be, and he gets to go wrestle now and then. And that's weird. But if he had showed up and said, yeah, I want this title, I like what it represents, and that would have given some credibility to it. And people are like, oh, Miro and Eddie Kingston, I'll pay to see that. But instead we get, the safe mid-card throwaway match as the way that you establish what the belt's all about. So I'm just throwing that out as an example. And you're like, well, everyone's in Japan. What are we supposed to do? Well, have Eddie Kingston give a celebratory promo and don't determine a challenger for the title. Stop using belts as a crutch to fill TV time.
In one night they've defined their new Triple Crown as being beneath the international title. I mean, this four-way would have felt unfair for an international title shot. I mean, none of these guys were even at that level.
Exactly. Okay, number two. My question is, JB in Detroit. Will Britt Baker still be – will she be part of the stable? I'd like to see AEW do more with intergender stables if they're going to be such a stable-heavy organization. Yeah, I thought Britt was going to be like kind of the mastermind. They just put Britt and Adam Cole together, and Britt, you know, and I thought they had a talking point, which was MJF trying to get Adam Cole to cheat on Britt at a bar, and you know, MJF was flippant about it, and you know, Britt could, that could have been the story where Cole was genuinely into MJF as a friend, and Britt kind of showed him the light, but that wasn't the story, and it's fine. I mean, it doesn't mean that my idea of a direction they might have been going in, and they don't, and that isn't true. It means they did an inferior angle, but I do think people go, wait, you know, where's Britt been? And if she's disgruntled for real and not just, you know, laying the groundwork for something else, it seems like it would be a good fit. And I do like the idea of an intergender stable with active wrestlers, men and women in the same group. And, you know, I've kind of pitched for that with a Bloodline, and I get, you know, it's kind of exclusive, but it's worked well for the Judgment Day. It feels like a lost opportunity to me, but maybe what they have planned for Britt otherwise is better, or maybe Cole doesn't want that, you know, and he's asked Tony Khan, don't put us on TV together for some reason. And TK respects that. I mean, I'm not aware of that, but, there could be other factors at play here, but I get JB bringing it up. Brandon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I'd prefer it. I think that if nothing else, it brings some star power to the group because, I mean, you have Adam Cole, and you have Wardlow, and then you have three guys that, like you said, have been defined as comedy characters. Britt Baker was, for a significant period of time, the most overact in the women's division by a pretty significant margin. So I think it would stand to reason that she could add some juice to the group. And I like the idea that they would have some other things to occupy themselves with because they would obviously be aiding Britt in her quest to, you know, go after either the women's world title or the TBS
yeah.
championship.
Or, I mean, it would have been a nice treat for us, step in the right direction. Tony Khan stepped up and said, next week on Dynamite or this Saturday on Collision or whatever, we're going to have a TBS versus women's title match. We're going to merge the titles. And we're going to have an international versus TV title match and merge the titles. I mean, just not more titles, but fewer. And because that stood out to me on the pay-per-view, having those, you know, two women's title matches. And neither felt even half as important as they would if there was one clear champion and one clear challenger. They both felt less than half as important to me because there were two belts indistinguishable from one another. There's nothing that defines why both need to exist. I mean, it's just, I mean, having an AFC champion and an NFC champion in the 60s made more sense than this does because it's the same league. It's just, it's like the NFL having two playoffs where every other team, if your team name ends in the first half of the alphabet, you get to be in one Super Bowl tournament. And if your team name ends in the second half of the alphabet, you end up in something for a Mega Bowl trophy. I mean, it's just, why? What's the purpose? Why?
The TBS championship felt like it was created for Jade Cargill. So
right.
It was the Jade Cargill title, and it was the Jade Cargill universe, not unlike the way that the TNT title felt like it was created for Cody Rhodes to exist almost exclusively in the Codyverse. And wouldn't you know, as soon as those two wrestlers passed on the championships, they seemed to lose all meaning. I mean,
yep.
with Cargill, and I think it was further exacerbated, too, in the women's division because Cargill became such a star so quickly that very, very quickly the TBS championship felt like a bigger deal than the women's world title because they'd done such a good job protecting Jade and building her up. And I don't think either title has ever really recovered since because Chris Statlander's reign as TBS champion just didn't work. And then while Julia Hart has been obviously the right move, putting the title on her, you've got Toni Storm sort of dividing the attention. And though you've got the titles on the two most over acts in the division, like you said, it's just sort of splitting interest.
Number three from him, Mariah May has a very believable and impressive dropkick. AEW does a great job with the double debuts. May and Peraza tonight and Cole Danielson previously. Obviously at different levels, but it's clearly a strategy. What do you think? Is it clearly a strategy, and do you like it?
I don't know if it's a strategy, but I thought that segment tonight was excellent. I thought that this was one of the better nights in a very, very long time for the AEW women's division. I just got done, knocking them down a peg, and now I'll build them back up because I think that it has been a really sore spot for this company since inception. And I have been very hard on the AEW women's division, and I think deservedly so. I think Khan has deserved a lot of criticism for the way that he's handled most of the characters and most of the booking. And I thought tonight was a really, really refreshing step in the right direction. I thought both women in the ring tonight look excellent. Mariah May looks like a star. I think that this was a great look and sign of things to come for her if they can continue with her on this trajectory. This felt like a professional match, something much more akin to what we would see out of the WWE women's division, which I think in a lot of ways has become a way to model your women's division if you are on a American television with you know, both men's and women's divisions. I think WWE has done a very good job over the last several years. And so this felt closer to their style of presentation. I thought Deonna Purrazzo's debut was excellent. It was smart to debut her in Jersey to guarantee that she gets a good reaction in front of the home crowd and you know, sort of sets the tone for future crowds, because that has been an issue with the women's division in AEW, is getting characters over and maintaining and ensuring that they stay over week in and week out. They've failed to do it with virtually everyone, with the exception of Toni Storm and Julia Hart. So to see Purrazzo get a good reaction right out of the gate, I think was a really good sign of things to come. And I really, really hope that they lean heavily into the presentation and format that they utilize tonight.
What do you think is the next stage in Mariah May and Toni Storm's dynamic, with Mariah May going clear heel? I don't think it was clear until now that she wouldn't be the sympathetic one who Toni Storm dismissed and disrespected and blew off. And she would sort of snap and go, you know, I was your number one fan, and now I'm going to take it out on you because you disappointed me, and would do so in a way where you're sympathetic for her, or vice versa. She goes too far in that regard, and you sort of get a misery movie plot point where the number one fan is like, oh, you know, I'm going. And then that's the way to turn Toni Storm babyface, which feels more natural. But it seems to me here, this seems to be a way to bring them together, because she stood up to her when Deonna Purrazzo showed up, and that Mariah May will actually ultimately serve a purpose that will cause Toni Storm to take notice of her. Is that where they're going, or and appreciate her and acknowledge her? Do you think that's where this is headed, or what?
I think it could be that. I sort of hope it's the former, though. I would like, because I think that Toni is better aligned as a babyface at this point, I think I would prefer that this sort of be the start of their unraveling, in the sense that Mariah May is still completely in line with Toni, and Toni is sort of, you know, treating her as the fan that she is. But Mariah May's confidence as she continues to wrestle grows and grows until she starts demanding attention from Toni Storm, and Toni Storm, you know, puts her in her place once Mariah May has been firmly established as, you know, as a big time heel. But I could see them going the other direction too, where Mariah May is, for the time being, sort of the proxy for Toni Storm as Toni ducks and dodges an obvious, you know, collision course with Deonna.
Yeah. All right, number four, I liked the Fire and Private Party's reunion promo and felt as though they got a surprisingly straight, strong crowd reception. I really hope they can get some momentum behind them as they support AEW's, that an AEW original tag team is contending in the division. I could see a good feud between them and the House of Black for the AEW tag team title should House of Black win the belts on Collision this Saturday. I was less high on it than JB. I thought it was a little clunky, and I wasn't quite sure how I was supposed to feel about him. I didn't have that support of the announcers. You know, sometimes the hand-holding can be a little patronizing from WWE. It's certainly been part of their DNA to have Michael Cole or whomever, like, really hammer home how we're supposed to feel. But this sort of felt like the announcers didn't know, you know, and you know, they didn't know how Toni Khan wanted them to be received. And so they just kind of called it every tag team. So I don't, like, are we excited they're back? Or do we think these are arrogant punks who I can't wait to get humbled and knocked off the pedestal that they've suddenly marched back and expect to be on? Did I miss something? Do you think they were more defined? Or do you think that's not important at this stage?
No, I don't think it was clearly defined at all. I don't know how much it matters at this stage. But I do think that the segment was a bit clunky, just because it – I mean, they came out – with a mission statement to put the tag team division on notice, but they got in the ring with teams that aren't really clearly defined. I mean, they were more so like, you know, trios teams, if anything. I mean, it just didn't really work. I could understand, you know, you come out and you say something like that after an FTR or an FTR and House of Black match, but I mean, you've got Orange Cassidy and Hook and Danhausen, which I guess is a quasi version of Best Friends, but not really. And then you've got Top Flight. Like, they're neither of these groups are known specifically as tag teams. So it just seemed like a very awkward and an opportune time for them to come out. I just think they would have been better with a backstage promo.
They also, I think, screwed up and played the wrong music, and then that's where the announcer's off. And I think that threw everybody off a little bit. I think there was a cascade effect of just everything being a little bit off because of that. And I think Taz was trying to like figure out what was happening and steer things back. But
which
yeah,
too often, I mean, it's live television, so there's bound to be mistakes. And I never fault these companies for making little mistakes like that. But it seems when they happen to AEW, they linger too long. Like that music played too long. I get it if you cue the wrong music, but like, cut it immediately. It shouldn't play for like 7 seconds.
Yeah. All right, and finally, I think we might get a Hangman Swerve Wardlow triple threat match for Joe's number one contender after tonight's main event and subsequent angle. As always, love the show and go VIP. No, we're not getting. Well, yeah, I don't know. I hope not. What do you think? JB thinks they're setting up? I mean, I think Swerve people want to see in the world title picture. He's declared he wants gold. He's declared which belt he wants, the world title. That's good. Hangman's a former champ, but he seems more just obsessed with Swerve or whoever gets in his way. And then, yeah, Wardlow is the able-bodied, serious badass in the Devil Group. So by definition, yeah, I mean, it seems like he's an opponent for Joe. But that sets up Joe as a tweener champion if he's going to be facing heel Wardlow. Popular Swerve, so it's a pick'em for the fans who like to cheer a heel, take your pick. And then Hangman, who actually might get booed against Joe, because I think Hangman's character is a little bit unhinged in a way that I don't think, you know, you can respect the brutality of his match and think, ah, he scored points with me as a fan that way. But as a character, he just does seem a little unhinged. I could see fans cheering Joe over him. I don't know. They got some work to do, in my view, in terms of getting this, one, just communicating to me what they think they're doing, and then doing it well or effectively.
Yeah, I don't think that they're in a great spot with any of the three directions right now. I mean, Hangman doesn't feel like a legitimate title challenger for Joe right now at this moment. Doesn't mean that they can't heat him up. I thought that Hangman had a really good start tonight. I mean, I joked on Twitter that, you know, he was showing up really late for work, which is always kind of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, WWE is guilty of that stuff too, but it was funny to see him carrying his bags like at what was it, like 9:45 and Eastern time, and he's just arriving. That I liked that. I liked that side of Hangman, not the carrying the bags part, but him just walking in on a promo with Daddy Magic and Renee and having a ton of fire and you know, saying he's there to beat somebody up. And I thought, all right, this is cool. Like this is the kind of thing that I want to see from Hangman at this point. And then the guy that he beats up is Swerve Strickland. Like it just took all the wind out of my sails. Like we've been there, we've done that.
Yep.
And I don't want to see Hangman Page beat Swerve Strickland right now. And I don't want to see Hangman Page lose to Swerve Strickland again. So what are we doing? I mean, there's just no one wins here. I mean, if Swerve beats him again, then you're really defining Hangman down. And if Hangman beats Swerve, then that really stifles Swerve's momentum. That feud just feels like it's done. I just don't see any reason at this point to revisit it. I would have preferred that Hangman just beat the crap out of anybody. I mean, Daddy Magic, whoever, take your pick. I mean, you can sacrifice any number of the hundreds of people on the roster to have Hangman snap on, and I think it would have worked much better. I get that they wanted that chaos to end the show, and it seemed like they were almost like giving themselves a declarative mission statement for the year, saying, hey, if night one is this crazy, what is the rest of the year going to be like? But, like, if this is what the rest of the year is going to be like, I don't want it. Like, it just didn't work. And I think circling back to Joe and where they're headed with that title picture, I get that they're going to get there with Wardlow, but Wardlow doesn't feel like he's primed for that match right now. And if they're going to do it this quickly, then they need to clearly define Samoa Joe as a babyface, like next week.
If you're going to have Wardlow be the able-bodied, serious person in the group that is the payoff to the Devil storyline, I would have put him in the Continental Classic. I would have put him against some great workers. I would have had him come up just short and come up with a story for that. And you can do it in a number of different ways, even without the interference option, where you're protecting him. And I would have had him be the guy who everyone looked at as, yeah, Eddie Kingston won, but what a statement Wardlow made. If you don't think he can make that statement, maybe he shouldn't be challenging for your world title. If you think he can make that statement, it's going to be hard to do it. I thought the Continental Classic would have been a challenge for him to not win, but come out of it impressive. But again, I think there's a way to have made that work. And frankly, him, you know, losing twice in the Continental Classic against top people isn't the end of the world. I mean, the Super Bowl champion this year is going to have lost games. The NBA champions this year are going to have lost lots of games. Every champion, you don't have to protect in an undefeated way whoever you're going to have challenging or winning a world title. So that is, to me, showing a commitment to a sports-like presentation is being a brave booker who has top people lose to other top people and understand that's part of the give and take of top competitors going at each other, just as happens when the Cowboys take on the Lions. And that's an example of a finish that I wouldn't want AEW to imitate, that Lions Cowboys finish. But there are things in pro wrestling you can do to get somebody advanced in points in a tournament without Wardlow deserved to win, even if he did.
And the thing is that obviously they've had this devil angle in the works for months and months, and presumably given the things that Wardlow had been saying in the lead up, they had a pretty good idea that he was going to be part of this stable. Why wasn't he being featured on TV on a consistent basis? Why wasn't he racking up wins against lower quality opponents?
And even just winning squash matches 4 years into your run in AEW, that's not progress. Like, why is he beating up scrubs? You know, no, people aren't going to be impressed with the Boston Celtics in the NBA if all they do is beat the San Antonio Spurs 3 out of 4 nights, or the Detroit Pistons. You know, I mean, there's a format used to introduce talent, but then there's a format, you know, then you move on from that. You don't go back to it. And a lot of AEW feels like it's in an endless spin cycle. And if you tuned out and tuned back in, you're like, wait, I've been gone. I haven't watched for 9 months or 15 months. Hangman is still hanging out with Dark Order and he's still moping around. Like, there's been those things that have just gone on forever. And Wardlow winning squash matches and not having any kind of character development beyond that or much of it, other than turning on MJF, has been a problem.
But I would still even take that over just not being on TV at all. I mean, he was virtually forgotten.
All right. From Iowa has called up and pushed one, so let's bring Greg on. Greg, welcome to the show. What's on your mind about Dynamite and our discussion so far tonight?
Yeah, hello. A lot of great thoughts being expressed here, and I feel like in some ways, like this conversation, without even me even consciously realizing it, is kind of reading my mind in a lot of ways. But it's interesting. I wanted to make one quick point about something you mentioned. I want to talk a little bit more about the women's division, but it's interesting you mentioned that 4-way match to determine a contender for Eddie Kingston, and one of the people in the match was Brian Keith, the Bounty Hunter, which is, you know, he's very talented. I like him, but he's another example of somebody being brought in, like, just, you know, he wrestles good and you're supposed to know who he is because he's, you know, made a name for himself, maybe, you know, in some independent promotions that some of the hardcore AEW fan base follows. But prior to this, two of his matches have been, he was in the 6-way match for the ROH television title at the Final Battle show, and then already lost to Orange Cassidy as well. So he's getting then a bad chance to become Eddie Kingston's number one contender. So I was just thinking about that because you mentioned that whole picture earlier. But also then I wanted to circle back to this women's conversation, because right now the big discussion is that one of my favorite wrestlers and the person who Mercedes Monet is rumored to be joining AEW at any point in time. Now, whether she actually does, nobody knows, I don't think, until she actually shows up somewhere. But it's interesting thinking about the conversation around the women's division, because I agree with Brandon. I thought that match between Mariah May and Queen Amanada was really solid. There was a lot of hard hits, and it was good work. And Queen Amanada was impressive as well. So I did like that match.
Yeah.
And thought that it was a pretty strong segment overall. And I will say with Toni Storm, one critique I would have is that I'd like to see the character be more serious, because I feel like her, as great as it is, as good of a character work as she does, as much as the fans love her, her character actually takes away, in my opinion, from her in-ring work, because I feel like her matches have actually been weaker than they would be otherwise, because the character is hanging over things. But going into the conversation going forward, that you mentioned that there appears to be a positive momentum going for AEW Women's Division. Tony Khan was very adamant at the World's End media scrum that he's going to be aggressive in going after, women's free agent women's wrestlers, and I guess we saw that with Peraza tonight. Of course, the Mercedes thing hanging over. But if she is to come to AEW, that's going to be the real litmus test, because, she's going to demand, and you were talking a little bit about this during the Raw show, when it was brought up, Wade, she's going to be wanting to be treated like a top star. She's going to be expected to be treated at the same level as the top male stars, because she's got a big fan base. She's got a lot of fans, and she's really, built up an equity for herself as far as being an established star and everything. And so that's going to be a real test of this. And so it's interesting, if this is beginning to pave the way for this, there's some positive momentum, but there's also there's going to have to be, I think, a change in philosophy of how, Tony Khan looks at women's wrestling. If he's going to bring someone at her level in, because this isn't just like a Toni Storm or a Saraya. This is going to be somebody who's going to be wanting to have matches and storylines that are on the same level as the top guys. So.
Yeah, yeah. Brandon, you want to react to any of that?
Yeah, that has been my concern with Mercedes Moné signing with AEW from the jump. Is that, I said a while back, and my opinion still stands, that if Sasha Banks or Mercedes Moné wants a lot of money, she can get that from either company. And I hope that if she is signing with AEW, that she's getting a very, very big deal. If she wants creative fulfillment, I think that she is going to have a significantly harder time finding it in AEW than she would in WWE. And that's not to say that WWE is perfect and the grass isn't always greener. She's been there before. She knows what the politics are like. She knows what the situation is like. But there is no question that they have a proven track record of treating their women stars like stars. And AEW has been unable to cultivate any consistency in their women's division since the inception of the company. I mean, you can point to women who have gotten over. I think Toni Storm, Julia Hart, if you look back a little bit further, Dr. Britt Baker, and a little bit more recently, Jamie Hayter. But none of those women have been enough in Tony Khan's eyes to elevate the division beyond what it has been, which is a one match per show, often in the least watched portion of any given Dynamite or Collision or Rampage, and a feeder / mid-card / bathroom break position on pay-per-views. And I'm not saying that the women that are under contract with AEW deserve that. I think that most of them have outworked what their position on the card has been, but that's been the presentation from the top down. And that is because of the poor booking and the one note booking and the very one-note, singular-focused feuds. There just isn't a lot of depth to the division, and there hasn't been for a significant amount of time. My fear is that Mercedes Moné shows up, and very quickly she is just brought into the fold, as every woman has been to date, and honestly, as a lot of the men have been. I mean, look at Adam Copeland, for example. Huge star in WWE. Very quickly felt like just another guy in AEW. And I think that's been better in the last few weeks. But there was about a month and a half there where it was a rough go. And I think that it's more likely than not that that happens to Mercedes in AEW simply because that is the history we have. We don't have any contrarian evidence to point to them being capable of something else at this point. I hope that that isn't the case. I hope that a star of her caliber means that there is going to be a significant increase in television time, in presentation, in storyline development for the women. And the biggest thing is I hope that Tony Khan and AEW is aware that they're bringing in a talent who has had the propensity to voice frustration very openly and publicly before. And if Mercedes Moné was not happy with how she was being presented in WWE, what do you think is going to happen if 3 weeks into her run, she's not showing up on TV, or she's being asked to do just a pre-tape promo, or she's being given 5 minutes for a match at 8:20 or 8:45 on Dynamite? It's not going to go well.
Yeah. Greg, back to you. Any response to that or anything else you want to bring up?
Yeah, and I'll follow up a little more with that because I was thinking about this, and it's interesting in the history of AEW's women's division. I may be missing a couple of matches here, but there have been some good matches. But as far as matches that I can think of that like hit that next level and are actually considered great matches, I can only think of two. And not to say there haven't been good matches, but as far as like great matches, I can't think of any that have happened on AEW pay-per-view. The two I can think of are the Britt Baker Thunder Rosa match that, of course, had a lot of added, blood and a lot of. It was not your typical match. And then there was a match on Dynamite in late 2022 with Sheeta and Jamie Hayter, where they just had like a really great main event. And really had a chance to, have an awesome match. But outside of that, it's like, and I don't think it's really the fault of the talent. Although, I've said things like, Toni Storm. I think the character work deviates. Takes away a little bit from what you could do in the ring, but just in general, there hasn't, and I don't. It's been like a real lack of matches that have like really hit that level. And Mercedes is somebody who, and people will argue about this and bicker about this because she's a very polarizing person, but she's somebody, on that matter of wanting to be treated like top stars, she's on pay-per-view, she's going to be wanting to have an opportunity to have the time and the build to be able to have, she's the type of person, like she would be motivated to want to try to go out and have the best matches on the show she's on. So it's once again, whether people think she does that or not, that's not the conversation for this or not, but I think that's been her outspoken mindset for pretty much her entire career. Just once again, just on the whole thing, there will just have to be a wholesale change in the philosophy. And, once again, it goes back to the characters. I mean, it's like, the last pay-per-view was Toni Storm, who, again, great character. I think the character takes away from like what she can do in the ring. And then of course you had, Julia Hart and Abaddon in a match that just unfortunately just really went nowhere. So, just once again, just thinking about like this, it would be very fascinating to see how this, this were to play out if that would happen, because it would require a change. But then again, also if it doesn't happen, yeah. Then then once again, Tony, I guess could probably, just continue to look at things the way he's always looked at it. But once again, just reiterating that it's going to have to be like a full-fail change in the philosophy if she were to come in. And I guess I'm done with that. Thank you.
Anything else you want to bring up or not?
Nope, I think I'm done.
Cool. All right,
nope,
great.
Thanks,
thanks, Ray. Yep, I didn't want to cut you off if you're like, yep, thank you, appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, very good. Good to hear from you. I think with Sasha and any top star, you can be defined down. If you get dropped into a company and you're not treated like a star, sometimes there's this realization that the machine behind you, the context that you're presented and the people you share the screen with had something to do with the fan perception, enthusiasm for you and the value that you had, that the promoter who bid for your services and acquired you had baked into your value. Tony needs to make sure he doesn't overpay for Sasha Banks. And in other words, whatever it would take to hire Mercedes Moné, he wants to get his money's. He ought to do what it takes to get the money's worth out of her. And part of that is setting the foundation, setting the table for her to come in to a strong women's division and not think just her being here is going to elevate everyone. You want to elevate everyone as much as you can and make that division feel important before she arrives. So she's dropped in and she's elevating something that has a sense of momentum instead of being seen as a savior who might end up actually being dragged down rather than rising the water level for everyone. And there's a chance that either can happen. And some of that just depends on, does Sasha Mercedes get exposed as benefiting from the context and the talent that you're surrounded by? And it's less than that booking wise, atmosphere wise, and the talent that she's wrestling in the ring wise, where it actually shows those things gave her a boost. I think that's the case for a lot of WWE wrestlers. A lot of them, I don't think, translate to AEW at an equal level as they do in WWE, because when you're at when you're at WrestleMania in these stadium shows, and when you're on Fox and you're against the roster of star power that they have and the machine that they have, it makes you feel like a bigger star. Not everybody, but people who are stars, it can make them seem like bigger stars. So that's just something to account for. That's why I think AEW should be showing that damn Wembley Stadium footage more. I mean, that should be in the opening of all their shows. I mean, that just sets the tone as this being a major international success story. And I don't think they use that footage enough. You know, don't just talk about it in media Q&As, like show us and remind people of it. Any excuse you have when you're doing a vignette or a personality profile on a wrestler going into their match, and if they were on that show, show footage of them in the ring in front of that crowd. That's part of framing people as big stars, is showing them in front of crowds that size. Anything else you want to add, Brendan? Yeah.
Yeah, with Moné, I just think, you know, Tony, so much of Tony's booking philosophy, and like you've kind of hinted at throughout, or, you know, sort of overtly said, it's not so much booking as it is just putting matches together. And so much of his philosophy is offering dream matches and just rolling out the red carpet and just doing them on Dynamite, Collision, whatever, just throw out dream matches. And I think of Mercedes Moné right now, and I just think, you know, what are the dream matches for her in AEW? And I'm not coming up with any, and I don't think that that's because the women aren't talented enough to stand up to her. It's because they haven't done the character work. They haven't put in the time necessary to build these characters to a point of wanting to see them in major significant feuds. One match tonight of Mariah May being presented like a star and wrestling a really good match. And I'd put her at the top of the list of people I want to see Mercedes wrestle already.
Yep.
And that's nothing against, you know, I'm not saying that's, I don't want to oversell her or undersell her. It's just the fact that so little has been done in the 4+ years that this company has existed on television, that the list is just very small.
I agree. Okay. A few other things we'll hit on before wrapping up here. One is Darby versus Takeshita. Did they advertise this?
I think that they did on the graphic coming in. They did put out like a very sports focused card. And I think it was on that, but I don't know how early they released it today.
Yeah. And to me, that felt like a big deal. So in the graphic they put out, which is kind of old school, but very much more colorful and graphically pleasing, but the old school insert in a program, they had Orange Cassidy and Dante Tal. And by the way, this is a really cool change. I noticed this earlier today, and I like the vertical orientation. And instead of doing it like a widescreen movie poster where it's a cluster mess, it's clear, delineated, there's this main event. It's the international title match, Dante Martin, Orange Cassidy. That made Dante feel like a star because he's at the top of the card, literally the card. The card is a word for a sheet of paper or card, and this is a simulation of it. And Dante's at the top of the card next to Orange, and I like that. And then they had Swerve and Garcia, which they billed as the main event, even though it was billed second on the lineup. Mariah May and Queen Amanada was advertised all week or for a long time. Then they advertised three promos. And then way down near the bottom is Darby Allin and Takeshita, which was a late addition unless I missed it. And to me, that's a really intriguing match. And frankly, more intriguing with all due respect than Swerve and Garcia or Dante and Cassidy. Darby's a bigger star than Orange Cassidy, arguably. They're in the same realm. And Takeshita has not been defined down. He's part of Don Callis's group. He might be the best wrestler is the best wrestler in that group. I like Kyle Fletcher, but to me, that just being way at the bottom and then having Darby lose like that, I'm kind of scratching my head over this. I'm not quite sure what was happening there. And then, and this is a separate topic that I meant to get into, but I'm staring at the card now. They had the Beretta, Cage, Brian Keith, Vikingo match at the very bottom, with this tiny little picture of Eddie Kingston saying he'd be on commentary for it. You just have this major tournament. You crown your new champion. It's three titles in one, and it's the last match on the billing with four randos, with losing records in some cases, at the very bottom of the card. Not a good way to kick off. So I'm just further underlining how I think they botched the formerly known as AEW Triple Crown title. But Darby and Takeshita, to me, that deserved 3 weeks of build. It should have been a bigger deal in terms of how this can affect the course of both of their careers or their years. And there should have been some stakes, and it just felt thrown on the card. This had more going for it than AEW gave it.
Yeah, I agree. And the result was fantastic. I mean, it was a really, really good match. And I was glad that they went all in with Takeshita too, because I thought that he is one of those guys who AEW did really wrong over the course of the last 6 months or so. I mean, they had something with him after the turn and joining up with Don Callis, and then he just disappeared for such a long period of time and lost so much momentum. And featuring him prominently in that match on Saturday, I thought was good. And then getting him a big win here against an established, AEW mainstay was a big deal. And the match was great. It was brutal. It was definitely one of the highlights for sure.
Yeah. And to me, that should have been a match they announced in the headline Collision or Dynamite with next week. And we got promos and we got Don Callis talking about it, and we knew what the stakes were. It deserved more of a spotlight than being in the filler match spot, which is basically what it got without that hype and context.
I think they wanted to quickly pivot to the setup for the tag match with Sting, which is unfortunate, but it does feel like they're doing a lot of booking around it feels a lot like anyone who is even semi-involved with Sting right now is sort of being shoehorned into situations to fit when they need Sting to show up in a city for the last time. So it just so happened to work out that way, where they wanted Sting to show up in, where is it? Are they in Richmond next week? We're back.
Yep, my internet went down, so I established a hot spot. We'll clean this up. Only live listeners will know this happened. So, Brandon, you're saying they did the match because they wanted to set up the tag title match.
Yeah, it felt like they wanted to set up the situation with Sting next week. And I had gotten to a point where I asked you, Wade, do you recall, are they in Richmond next week? Is that where Dynamite is?
Oh, you know what? I don't know. Jacksonville. They did say.
So they were setting up for Friday for Sting to show up on, or Saturday, sorry, for Collision, because they're in either Richmond or one of those areas. It's going to be the last time that Sting appears there. That's the crux of what I was getting to. So it feels like they're setting these situations and setting the table just to get to moments where Sting is going to show up to make his final appearance. And I understand why they're doing that. They want to give these big moments for Sting, but it's also kind of hurting the booking of the guys surrounding it. Because I think you could have saved this match had they not wanted to set Sting up to show up for Collision to cut a promo with Darby about the tag match next week.
Yeah, this is booking backwards from the place you want to be. And frankly, the Garcia Swerve match felt that way, because that match just felt like it was quote, good match filler until Hangman showed up to have stared on with Swerve. And you shouldn't put a match that doesn't belong in the main event, which I would argue Garcia Swerve isn't at the level of Dynamite main event, without some build and context. But in their mind, they're like, well, we're booking backwards from the stare down at the end of the show. Okay, fine, but you've got some work to do, which is called being a booker who plans 3 weeks ahead, so that you can lay the groundwork for there being a context why this deserves the words main event as a description and its placement on the show. And they just didn't do that. I mean, Swerve is borderline a main eventer right now because he's on the rise and people see him that way. And he's had great match, but he hasn't headlined a pay-per-view. He's not a former world champion. If you're going to headline with Swerve, you need a wrestler who's already established at that level, or you need a backstory. And they didn't give it either. So it felt like a weak main event to kick off the year. Not match quality-wise. That's a given. That's baked into every criticism of AEW. They have great matches. I know that. That's not the be-all, end-all, though. And so same thing with this match. It deserved more than being the match that fills time till we get to the reason the match exists. And the way you do that is you plan 3 weeks ahead and you set it up so the singles match doesn't just seem like a conduit to get somewhere else. Because that cheapens what they just did in a way. You know, what they went through, if it is just, oh yeah, we're just here to set something else up.
I also take issue too with moving right to that Sting and Darby match with Takeshita and Powerhouse Hobbs, because it feels like Darby is just going to get his win back with Sting, because they virtually never let Sting lose. And I understand why, but I think you've got something with Takeshita, and I wouldn't want to put him in that situation. Even if it's Powerhouse Hobbs who's going to take the fall, I just don't think after giving him a big win against Darby that you'd then want to turn around and give it right back.
Agreed. Okay. Final segment I've talked about is Christian Cage and Shayna Wayne doing some more talking. Talk about that segment and what you thought of it. Obviously, we had, you know, the buildup was such, and we see it in wrestling, where somebody thinks they're going to be talked about, so they really overact, as Luchasaurus Killswitch was, like, he's about to talk about me, and his body language says it, and he's just in you over the head with a sledgehammer with a build and anticipation. And the Bloodline did that recently with Jimmy, where Roman was going to give credit to him and didn't. And so we had that here, and it's great. It's entertaining. Christian's great. But if you bought into it, I mean, come on. You had to see that coming. I think most people saw it coming. But even if you see it coming, it doesn't matter. It was really entertaining. Christian was really good. Shayna's like saying, how dare you, boo. Mom was good. Nick Wayne, I won't say he stole the show, but he is so good standing there as that smug heel who you just want to see get slapped. And Killswitch Luchasaurus, even though the acting was a little over the top, in terms of, yep, puffing my chest out, Christian's about to give me credit, it worked. You know, I mean, that's when you don't have facial expressions, you got to overdo it on body language a little. Kane did that so well in his day. So anyway, what do you think of this segment, Brandon?
Yeah, I thought it was good, as most things that Christian is involved in tend to be. I mean, he's so good and he's so entertaining at this point, and walks such an incredibly fine line, because, you know, AEW has these smart audiences and caters to them in a very specific way. And that's why I think a lot of times you have the heel or the cool character getting over, and Christian just finds ways to gnaw at that. So just when you think that, you know, they're going to turn, the tide's going to turn, and they're going to cheer for Christian because he's just so good at what he's doing, he says something or does something or makes some comment that snaps the crowd right out of it and turns him into the full-blown heel that he is. He's just been a joy to watch. And at times where I have been really, really down on Dynamite, Christian segments are usually the saving grace for me. and I I thought that the bit players in this were good. Luchasaurus or Killswitch was good. No question that the tease was very overt, and he had me at first. Like at first, when Christian first turned to Killswitch and gave the first superlative, I thought, oh, okay, well, he's going to say something nice about Luchasaurus. But then as soon as he upped the ante and continued on, it became so blatantly obvious that he was about to give thanks to himself. And I think that's what made it work so well. They're planting the seeds effectively for the eventual turn, and I like the fact that the crowd got really into it too and was chanting Luchasaurus, and Cage just kept speaking over them, just mm-hmm. refused to relent, refused to let them get him off track. He just plowed right through it. Nick Wayne has been, standing there, the facial expressions are usually good. Sometimes he almost cracks up at something Christian says. He did that tonight too. I'm still not super high on the Shayna Wayne stuff. I completely understand why she costs Adam Copeland the match. That made plenty of sense to me. But she was still the mother in the crowd who was just completely horrified at the things her son was doing at direction of Christian Cage. So for her personality to switch so drastically to me is still a stretch for someone who is in a non-wrestling role and presumably will never be in a wrestling role. I would have just preferred that her involvement stopped at screwing over Copeland, and then she just said, hey, look, I'm disgusted by both of these guys. I'm disgusted by the fact that Adam Copeland hurt my son. I'm disgusted by the fact that Christian Cage is who he is, and he has indoctrinated my son. But at the end of the day, he's an adult now. He can make his own decisions, and that be the end of her involvement. Because I just don't know that they're getting enough out of her as a character to make it worth it, to make the logical leap worth it. But I do get a kick at least out of Christian referring to her as the matriarch. I mean, that's funny, but I think it would still be just as effective without her.
Yeah. On another point, should they have addressed the contractual transaction loophole and acknowledged, or is it better not bringing it up because it's maybe just something you want to move past, that the transferability of that win?
I think it's fine. It's wrestling. I mean, I think people – not that that's a good excuse for most things, but I think it's so baked in at this point. And the fact, too, that, the contract was so fresh, the fact that that was an issue I had had on Saturday. The fact that, so many people don't watch the pre-show or aren't necessarily paying close attention to the pre-show. They should have shown a clip of Luchasaurus winning the Battle Royal. I mean, that would have made a ton of sense. And they didn't. They just assumed that everybody had seen the fact that he'd won and had the contract, and suddenly he pulled it out and they just carried on as if it was something that he'd been carrying for months, like Money in the Bank. I think they're probably better off for just having moved on from it.
Anything else you want to bring up from the show tonight?
I think just in summation, I said to start, there was some stuff that I thought was really, really strong on this show. I think most notably the Darby Allin and Konosuke match, and then the women's segment. I thought that was my favorite part of the show, personally, just because I've been so down on that division as a whole, and I thought that this was a stark contrast to the way that they've been presenting characters and women's matches. So that was a pretty refreshing sight for me. I said earlier that this didn't feel like a drastic departure from what they were doing, and I think I'd slightly revise that just to say that the women's segment felt like the one exception to that rule for me.
Cool. Well, Brandon, thank you. Fun discussion tonight.
Yeah, definitely. It was certainly a noteworthy show to kick things off, even if it was strange at times. So glad I got to talk about it.
Yes. Thank you so much. Check out Brandon and Greg Parks with their World Collide post show. It's free. Search PW Torch on your podcast app.
to subscribe, or go to pwtorch.com, and there should be a link there too to it. Yeah, they were live right after the show and discussing the latest AW pay-per-view to close out 2023. Thanks, everybody, for your support. Keep spreading the word. Give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us, and leave some kind comments and recommendations if you enjoy what we do. And we'll talk to you Friday night. Travis Bryant from the PW Torch East Coast cast will be joining me as co-host on the SmackDown Post Show this Friday. And Rich Van, Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Rich Van, joined me yesterday on the flagship, our Blue Logo Show. Search Wade Keller in your podcast app and subscribe to that for free. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon, Brandon. Happy New Year.